This is a podcast edition of Dialect Radio's weekly show. We're coming to you from Bristol City Centre, just off Queen Square, and we're part of the Bristol Radio Co-op. Hello to everyone in Bristol, and also to our listeners, wherever they are in the world. Good evening, and welcome to Dialect Radio for Saturday the 5th of December. I'm John Peters Coleman.
And I'm Katie Austin.
Well, this week you can picture autumnal leaves falling upon a wide boulevard, because we have a Parisian theme this week. Anthea Page has been over the sea to Paris, where she met up with stateless, so-called illegal workers, marching for their rights as part of an 8-week strike. We also have our latest instalment of Norman Baker MP's gripping tale of murder in the run-up to the Iraq War and the circumstances surrounding the death of government scientist and peacemaker Dr. David Kelly. We also have a report on Thomas Chaston Society from Lucy Hillier, and we finish with the very own Richard Stilgo, Trevor, the Bard of Windmill Hill, and of course, Jeff Sparks' What's On Guide for this week.
But as we start this week, we've gone one better than the Moulin Rouge. We've got fresh from filming for ITV's Fantasy Wishes with Amanda Holden, one of the original Bluebell girls. Welcome, Miss Jane Sullivan. It's good to meet you.
Hello, Katie. It's good to meet you.
So the Bluebell Girls are a dancing troupe, is that right?
That's correct, yes. They were formed by a lady called Margaret Kelly back in 1932. She was originally known as Bluebell because of her blue eyes. And when she did form the Bluebell troupe, that's why they were called the Bluebell Girls. But originally, her very first troupe in 1932 were called the Hot Jocks. But she did come on a little bit from there to establish her famous troupe at the Lido on the Champs-Élysées in Paris.
Cool. So, well, yeah, that sounds a little bit more elegant than the Jocks, I've got to say. So, but you're not a founder member, obviously. How long were you with the Bluebells?
I joined them in 1969 when I was 18, and I stayed with them for 3 years.
We'll let the listeners do the maths there.
Absolutely.
So what are they doing now? They're still going, I
absolutely, assume. Yes. They're a very famous troupe still at the Lido on the Champs-Élysées in Paris. And basically, I was very fortunate when I was working with Amanda to go and see the show that's being held there at the moment. It's absolutely stunning and beautiful. It's still very much the theme of very international dancers, big dance troupe, with lots of different people actually in the show as well. There's someone there with actually a dress harness horse doing musical dressage. There's some people there who are muscular men lifting each other up. But the whole show is just so stunning, with beautiful costumes. And of course, the girls and the boys who are known as the Kelly Boys. So it's a very long 2-hour spectacular show that one would just, you know, adore to go and see.
And is it very different from your experience of the show?
It's similar in the fact that the theme is very much the same, but basically it's far more modern, and I think the costumes are far more glamorous.
Yeah, and how did you get involved, or why did you get involved? Were you a born dancer from the age of 2?
No, not really. I wanted to be a ballet dancer, but from the age of 7, I realised I was growing far too tall to be a ballerina. I was always given the boys' parts.
Simple.
So I gave it up for a few years. And then I met a wonderful lady in Bristol called Angela Redgrave, who now runs the Bristol School of Dancing. And I was encouraged to go and join as a 14-year-old, very much really because of my height. To be proud of my height at being 5'11" and not stooping all over the place. So basically I went to her and trained with her for, you know, quite a few years. And she was the one who encouraged me to perhaps take an audition for Miss Bluebell in London, which I did at 17. I then came back to ballet school for another 6 months and then joined my first troupe with the Bluebells when I was 18.
Yeah, and we know you as Jane, obviously, but you were Joanna, weren't you? You had your own
yes.
Star name.
Well, basically, there were 3 Janes, and so it all got a little bit complicated. And the 2 girls at the flat I was sharing at the time, they decided that they would call me Joanna. So that was my stage name. Absolutely.
And what was your kind of experience in the show? Were you training 24/7? Was it hard work?
Yes, it was. Yes, we would have 3 weeks of rehearsal, intense rehearsal. And then once the show was opened, we would continue to have rehearsals every week to make sure that the the whole show was kept together in a tight format. And so basically there would be a captain of that particular troupe, and she would take rehearsals on a regular basis just to keep us all in line.
So was it anything like the Moulin Rouge? Or was it
it's just a little bit different. It's a little bit different. I think the Moulin Rouge is still very well known for its can-can and high kicks. And I think the Lido is a little bit more, I would say, stylish, very run smoothly. And you'll all be able to see it at the end of January when Amanda actually takes the lead in that programme as a Parisian showgirl. And you will see her actually going through the rehearsals and then going in as lead of the show at the end of her show. She will become one of the lead principal dancers.
So is she a big fan of the Blue Bloods?
Absolutely.
How did you get involved in the show?
Well, basically, she had three fantasy wishes. One of them was to be a Parisian showgirl. Mm. So she was invited to go over to Paris and train at the Lido with the Bluebell girls. And they wanted to find three other ladies who were of the Bluebells, but in different eras. So I went over from the 1960s. Another lady called Sheila West came from the 1970s. And we met another lady who still lives in Paris from the 1980s. And we took part in the show with her, being interviewed in a restaurant in Paris, where we all sat and talked about our memories to enable her to get a feel of what it was like to be a Bluebell in our time, and also to give her some hints and tips of perhaps how she should perform, you know, nowadays as well.
Fantastic. Would she make a good Bluebell, do you think?
She's a little bit short.
Oh, is she? That's not good.
No.
Was it good to go back to Paris?
Has it changed? Amazing. I haven't been back to see the show in 40 years.
But has
and
Paris changed?
It's just the most romantic city. And no, it's so exciting. And to walk up the Champs-Élysées and see the Arc de Triomphe. And it was just fantastic. Mm. Really warm, summery day, although it was in the autumn. And we had an absolute ball. And we're very well taken care of by ITN, who looked after us very well.
Fantastic. Well, I'm sure we look forward to seeing that. But is it always that romantic, though? I mean, the life of a dancer, we see
absolutely
the glamour.
Absolutely not. It's hard work, broken toes, hot sweat and tears. But basically, it's something you absolutely adore. It becomes part of your life. You become very disciplined. And in any form, being an artist, an actor, a singer, it's something you always have to work hard at. But at the end, it's the ultimate opening night. There is nothing like it, and to be part, and so privileged to be part of that troupe. And next June we're all going back. Over 400 girls are going to go back to the Lido next June to celebrate what would be Miss Bluebell's 100th birthday. Unfortunately, she died 3 years ago at 97. She was still acting and working as a choreographer.
Well, that's quite a life. It's obviously very very healthy hobby. I mean, you still look intense, elegant. I can see you sitting there with your dancers poised. Do you still dance a lot?
Only socially, and I still like to be able to keep myself fit and healthy.
Yeah.
But it will be lovely to go back and see all the other girls and see people that we worked with in our particular time as well.
I'm wondering, are all those memories good though? Because I mean, you were in Paris at quite a turbulent time. Obviously, were you affected by the riots? Or?
Not at all. But we also worked in other different parts of the world. We were in Spain and we were in Argentina as well, and particularly Argentina at that particular time. Yes, it could be a little bit turbulent, but we were very well taken care of.
Excellent. Did you pick up any handsome stallions on the dance floor?
Several.
I was making no implication there, but you know.
No, we had a very good social time, obviously, and we would get invited to the Ambassador's Palace or wherever we were. We were known as celebrities, but we were always ambassadors of our country and would promote whatever country we came from. So we had to really behave ourselves as well.
Fantastic. Well, I'm sure we look forward to seeing that on our screens in 2010.
Absolutely.
We'll look out for the fantasy wishes with Amanda Holden. Anyway, Jane Sullivan, thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Katie, and you. Thank you.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk.
Bristol was recently the venue for an extraordinary conference. Alternative View 3 showcased about 15 challenging speakers from around the world. One of the most powerful speakers was Liberal Democrat MP for Lewes in Sussex, Norman Baker. He took a year out from the Lib Dem front bench to research and write a book about the so-called suicide just before the illegal invasion of Iraq of government weapons inspector David Kelly. In a talk timed to coincide with the opening of the Chilcot inquiry, but not covered by any of our local media, Norman Baker proves, beyond reasonable doubt, that Thames Valley Police and the Oxfordshire Coroner failed catastrophically in their job, that the government scientist, respected around the world for his peacemaking efforts, did not commit suicide, but was indeed murdered.
Now let me give you the official version of events, as Lord Hutton will describe it. The events of that particular committee meeting were harrowing for David Kelly, so Lord Hutton will tell us. He wasn't used to that. He came away thinking his career was at an end. He was very depressed. He then spent a couple of days mulling over it, and on the Thursday, he left his house for the last time, carrying with him his boyhood knife and 30 coproximal tablets, with the intention of slitting his wrist, taking the tablets, either to aid death or to deal with the pain of the wrist slitting, and there he passed quietly away on Harrowdown Hill. That explanation is wrong in virtually all regards. Let me deal with his mood first of all. And his mood is, if you like, circumstantial. It's not possible to always be inside someone's mind. But insofar as we can tell what was in his mind, he was certainly not suicidal. First of all, those I've spoken to who know him very well, including UN weapons inspectors, colleagues, close friends, those who live in his village, all will absolutely state that he was the last person in the world to commit suicide. He had dealt with very harsh and difficult episodes, including revealing, forcing out details of an illegal bioweapons program by the Soviet Union / Russia, and indeed the Iraqis in the early 1990s. He was not the person to be intimidated by a bunch of MPs. However, that you might say that we don't know whether that's really what he was like. That's not proof, and I accept that. He went to the Intelligence and Security Committee the next day, on the Wednesday. This is generally not known, but I've got the transcript from that meeting. He gave evidence there. He was in much better form, even cracking jokes. And on the Thursday, the last day of his life, he was sending emails to friends saying the worst was over. I was looking forward to getting back to Iraq, and he actually spoke to the Ministry of Defence and booked a flight to Iraq the following Thursday. Emails were sent at 11:18, shortly before he left the house for the last time. In addition to that, his wife was ill in bed that lunchtime, and his daughter was about to be married. So it had to be a particularly selfish act, I think, for him to have gone to commit suicide at that point. And all the evidence, circumstantial evidence, on his mood suggests that that was a highly unlikely action for him to have taken. However, that is not definitively proven one way or the other. What is much more difficult to rebut is the clear evidence which can be accumulated concerning the alleged method of death. The knife which he was supposed to have used, we never saw it. It was never produced at the Hutton inquiry, but we're led to believe it was a knife he'd owned since boyhood. It was a sort of gardening knife with a lip on it. It was also a blunt knife. It was the most curious weapon to use if you were out to try and kill yourself. We're told that he cut the ulnar artery. The ulnar artery, for those who aren't medically qualified, and I wasn't and still not, but I've learned about the ulnar artery, is in your hand here. It is only accessed by cutting nerves and tendons. It would have been particularly painful to have cut through nerves and tendons to get to this artery, particularly using the knife which I've just described. It's also an artery of matchstick thickness, and therefore, you might think, unlikely to cause death by loss of blood. Particularly as you use a blunt knife, the wound will heal up more quickly than if you use an absolutely sharp knife. I asked the national statistician, Karen Dunnell, how many people had died from cutting the ulnar artery in 2003 in the whole of the UK. The answer, you may be surprised to know, is one, presumably Dr. Kelly. If you want to, and I'm not suggesting you do want to do this, but if you were to want to cause death by loss of blood, then the suggestion is you might cut your arm this way and put it in hot water. I'm told that's the way you might achieve death. Don't try this at home, as you used to say on Blue Peter. Many people will assume that what you should do is, in fact, to cut the radial artery across here. And certainly that's what they'll do on television programs. And and that, of course, will cause the loss of blood to a far greater degree than it would cutting the ulnar artery. Interestingly, a study of U.S. prisons and attempts by U.S. prisoners to kill themselves by cutting the radial artery in the 1990s showed that, I haven't got the figure in my head, I think of one out of 279 prisoners only was successful in killing themselves by cutting the radial artery, which would have caused a loss of a great deal more blood than cutting the ulnar artery. So even that is uncertain, at the very least, to cause death. It's also the case if you cause a wound of any significance, blood will spurt out because the heart obviously is still beating and pushing the blood round. So you might think, might you not, that in those circumstances there'd be rather a lot of blood around Dr. Kelly's body if he's supposed to have bled to death. Not an unreasonable assumption. Yet when the paramedics arrived on the scene in Harrowdown Hill, they weren't actually clear how you were supposed to have died. Why was that? Because there was no blood. There was no blood evident. The only blood on his clothing was a small spot of blood about the size of a 50p piece on one knee, and his left arm had been was blood-soaked. Consistent, I might also say, with a cut after death rather than one before it. If he was going to have cut his ulnar artery with his right hand, which obviously he would have had to have done, you might have expected blood to have spurted up and to cover his right hand and his right sleeve. Not a single drop of blood, not one, was found on his right hand or his right sleeve. How can this be? Extraordinary feat from David Kelly to be able to cut in that way and leave not a single drop of blood. And there are some other curiosities as well about this knife and the alleged method of death. I asked the Thames Valley Police in a Freedom of Information request subsequent to the Hutton inquiry whose fingerprints were on the knife. Do you know what they said? They said to me, I've got it in writing, there were no fingerprints recovered from the knife. Very curious for David Kelly to have been able to cut his ulnar artery without leaving fingerprints. He wasn't wearing gloves either, by the way, just in case you're wondering about that. My Pedersen, who was perhaps David Kelly's closest friend, they were Baha'i faith members together. They worked together in Iraq. She was, is in the US Army. I've spoken to her at some length. She says that David Kelly had, earlier on that year, injured his right elbow quite badly. And when they had a meal together in a restaurant, so bad was the injury, he was unable to cut steak with his right hand. And yet here we are expected to believe that he chose his right hand to cut with a knife into the ulnar artery. David Kelly knew more about the human body than most people. If he had wanted to commit suicide, he could certainly have chosen a more effective and certain way than a method which had killed nobody so far that year in the UK. It is inconceivable a man of his knowledge and intelligence would opt for such a clumsy method to try to kill yourself. Now, we're also told by the Hutton inquiry that a contributory factor to his death was the ingestion of coproximal tablets. And certainly in his jacket at the scene where he was found, there were three blister packs neatly put in inside his jacket of 10 coproximal tablets each, and altogether 29 tablets were missing. One tablet, for whatever reason, had been left inside in situ. We are then perhaps invited to conclude that David Kelly must have swallowed 29 coproximal tablets. And yet, The official toxicologist at the Hutton Inquiry, Alex Allen, said there was less than half a tablet in his stomach when he was examined. And even if you allow for the possibility that the tablets had metabolized into the bloodstream, he concluded that there was less than half the lethal dose at maximum available to kill him. Coproximal tablets are also implicated in liver failure. Had you taken an overdose of coproximal tablets and failed to kill yourself, you would cause yourself significant long-term liver damage. Again, I don't think it's very likely that someone like David Kelly would have taken that risk. Had he wanted to kill himself, which I don't think he did, but had he wanted to kill himself, I'm sure he wouldn't have chanced long-term liver damage with an uncertain means of suicide. There's another curiosity as well about these coproximal tablets, or quite a few curiosities really, but one of the curiosities is that Maya Pedersen again made it known that David Kelly had an aversion to swallowing tablets. He would avoid doing so. He would take liquid solutions rather than swallowing tablets. So we're invited to believe that David Kelly is suicidal, he's masochistic, and he's illogical. I don't think he was any of those things, as a matter of fact. Now, in order to swallow the tablets, you might think that he would require a good deal of water, because if you try swallowing 29 tablets of coproximal tablets with a long axis, that will require a good degree of water. You might also conclude, as medical opinion suggests, that if you have lost a lot of blood, as we're invited to believe he has done, he's supposed to have bled to death, then the body, in those circumstances, will want to consume water as a compensation. So did he consume a lot of water? There was a water bottle there. It was rather curiously placed, 10 inches from his left shoulder, which is difficult to see how he would put it there. But the water bottle itself was one of those small ones you buy at railway stations for about a pound. It was about half full. So we're invited to believe that in order to swallow 29 tablets and compensate for the loss of blood, he actually only swallowed half a bottle of water. The bottle was smeared with blood. So I asked Thames Valley Police whose fingerprints were on the water bottle. No fingerprints were recovered from the water bottle, they told me, which makes you wonder how the blood got on there.
Norman Baker, the Liberal Democrats MP, talking last month in Bristol about his investigation into the strange death of David Kelly. And the book of the same title is available from all good bookshops, there's that ubiquitous phrase, as well as the DVD of his talk, which is available from thealternativeview.co.uk and avtv.info. More from Norman Baker next week.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
Back to the boulevard, so you can't go to Paris and not see a demonstration taking place somewhere. It's part of the French culture. Dialect's reporter Anthea Page was there last weekend and joined in with one. The demonstration was in support of the undocumented workers, mainly African and Chinese, about 300,000 to 400,000 of them throughout France, who have been working up to, in some cases, 10 years in that country, paying taxes and social security out of their wages, but they still have no residency status. This means that they are not covered in any cases of illness or accidents. Many of the big companies, one of which is the Paris Metro, employ these workers indirectly through temporary work agencies. The government know that widespread exploitation is going on. The first strike by undocumented workers took place last year. Many of them were working on building sites or restaurants. The main union, the CCT, coordinated the strike and managed to get the official papers for between 1,000 to 2,000 workers. The present strike in Paris is in its eighth week at the moment, and they only reacted after 6 weeks. Before that, there was a total blackout in the press about the issue. No news at all. They have promised a new bill to grant 1,000 workers official papers, but this is just a tiny drop in the ocean. Many of the workers live and work in France and send money back to extended families in Mali or Senegal. Without these payments, their families, and that's their wives and children who don't see them for years, would die of starvation. Some of the sound quality in this recording is poor due to the hectic nature of the location, being in the middle of a demonstration.
Qui existe depuis 7 semaines et c'est notre manifestation. Nous sommes le collectif du 19e, un collectif très unitaire puisqu'il regroupe toutes les organisations de gauche, tous les syndicats et toutes les associations du 19e.
Can you say a few words in English? What's your name?
My name is Leila.
And why are you here today?
I'm here because we have a big strike in France now for the undocumented workers in France called les sans-papiers. And they are working in France. They pay, taxes. They pay taxes and they are threatened by the government now because the government wants them to go out from France.
To leave?
Yes, to leave, sorry.
French, les gens de France?
Yes, French workers are very sympathized with them. Because, you know, they are workers, French workers and immigrant stranger workers, and now they are together against the racist laws from the government.
Is that in the Communist Party?
It's not only the Communist Party. We have the Communist Party, the Socialist Party. We have
trade unions
like CGT, like FSU, a lot of trade unions, probably all the French trade unions, and all left political parties in that demonstration today, and it was good.
So, have there been any arrests today?
Sorry?
Arrestation par la police?
No.
Should we?
No, because we were very, very, very
peaceful.
Yes.
So, do you think the government will take note of the demonstration?
I hope so. I hope that because the government have no choice. Because if he don't notice what happened in France now, he's completely deaf. Excuse me?
Est-ce que vous pensez que la situation est devenue plus mauvaise si il n'attend pas à la question, le gouvernement?
Oh, you think that the strike will
escalate?
Yes. And it's dangerous for the government because when workers stop to work, it's very important for the economy of the country. Sorry.
So what effect has the strike had so far on the economy of France? Quel effet la grève a eu sur la France?
Now,
economic.
For example, we have now the mayor of Paris is building a tramway, you know? Now, and we have strikers on this tramway, so the construction of the tramway is stopped now. So the mayor of Paris has to support strikers if it wants the tramway will be built. Do you understand?
To be finished.
Yes.
So c'est fini now.
Yes.
Was this the biggest demonstration for some time in Paris? Yeah,
for the undocumented workers, yes, it is. But in France, we have a lot of big demonstrations in general.
I think we can't reach the ministry because there is some police force.
So,
just a second. Yes. Ouais, Martine. T'es où? Ben, je suis à la fin de la manif, là, il y a le cortège PC qui se disloque. Mais là, je vois que ça chauffe en tête, là. Je vais aller voir en tête. Non, je vais aller voir en tête, là. Ça a l'air de chauffer, là.
It's getting quite noisy.
Yes, because, in fact, traditionally in a demonstration in France, you can't reach, if you have a presidential palace or parliament, you can't reach the target of the demonstration. You have the police forces just behind and you can't reach. But
and this is the end of the manif, and it's so noisy because maybe the demonstrators are hungry, I don't know.
So what happens now?
I don't think it's going to have some violent issue because many demonstrators are without papers and they don't want to be caught by the police. I think they're gonna
people are beginning to disperse. Hello. Is it police?
The policemen.
Oh yeah.
Are blocking the manifestation.
Oh, pourquoi?
Because they are blocking the manifestation because we should have go to the minister of immigration, and the policemen are blocking the manifestation, and we are. Angry.
We are disgusting.
No, it is disgusting.
Yes, sir. So how old are you?
What?
How old are you?
I'm 15.
I'm 15 too. So why are you in politics at such an early age?
Because it's a budget. Yeah, there's no age for politics, I think.
We support the sans-papiers.
Because there are some without young person without papers who are studying in France and they are expelled.
Do you have any friends who have this problem?
Yeah, in my next comment ancien, in my college there were two boys who were in classes and they were expelled.
They were expelled?
Yeah.
Because they hadn't got papers.
Yeah.
And what happened to them?
They go back in their countries.
Which country was it?
It was Cameroon. Sorry?
Do you know if they are safe in Cameroon?
I don't know, but I don't think so. I think life in Cameroon is much more harder than in France. And in Cameroon, they can't study.
They were just studying in France.
Well, that was Anthea Page in the Latin Quarter in Paris, talking to demonstrators about the undocumented workers in France.
BCFM Community Radio for Bristol on 93.2 FM. For more information or to listen live on the internet, go to our website at www.bcfm.org.uk. BCFM, your radio.
Eagle-eared listeners will know that over the last couple of weeks, we have been joined in the studio live by Michael Doble, the chairman of the Thomas Chatterton Society, and a very interesting bloke he was too. It's with much surprise that we discovered this poet was local and lending his name to an annual literary competition for local school children. This year, they had to produce a short story about one of Chatterton's favourite topics, animals. During the celebration of this event, several noted academics were also going to speak, and afterwards, our Lucy Hillier had the pleasure of chatting to one of them, Dr. Daniel Cook of Bristol University. Also attending and performing at this year's event were the Backwell Players, featuring a selection of songs from their show The Marvellous Boy, a name affectionately awarded Chatterton by William Wordsworth. Our Lucy also spoke to the show's composer, Terry Milton.
I'm here with Dr. Daniel Cook of Bristol University. Daniel, according to your CV, you've done a PhD in the poet Thomas Chatterton. Why him, and what did that PhD involve?
Well, yes, I completed my PhD last year at Cambridge. Chatterton was greatly admired by John Keats, Wordsworth, Tennyson, Oscar Wilde, great names in literary tradition. There are so many great myths about Chatterton, his early death, his prolific output of poetry, and so on. But it's true.
So, for you, how does it feel to be standing here in the middle of glorious St. Mary Redcliffe Church, knowing that we're standing just beneath the Chatterton room where he supposedly found these parchments, and from that he created this persona of the monk Rowley? What's your personal feelings about that?
Oh, it's fantastic, and it's only relatively recently that the church has embraced Chatterton. For a long time there was a stigma against him for supposedly being a suicide, which is a myth that is now being challenged.
So what would you like to see? What would your work achieve? How would you push that yourself if you had a choice?
Yeah, it's about getting the right balance. The Backwell players were so fantastic tonight. It would be great to see more involvement with theatres and local student theatre groups and so on.
How do you think Chatterton himself would feel about the society and what this group of you have achieved tonight, and the fact that you're encouraging young people and young scholars to embrace his ideas? What do you think he would say?
I think he'd write a satire on it. I think he'd find it quite ridiculous.
Lovely. Dr. Daniel Cook, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
And now I'm here with Terry Milton, the composer of a show of Thomas Chatterton called Marvellous Boy. Terry, can you tell me what actually brought you into this project?
The writer James McVeigh sent a script to the Bristol and Vic Company to actually try and ask them if they could possibly stage the production for him. Anyhow, what happened was the script finally finished up on my table. I don't know how it happened. And it was written as a play, in fact. But I contacted Jimmy and I said, Jimmy, I think maybe this would make an extremely good musical. What do you think about that idea? And he came back to me and said, yes, Terry, I think that's a fine idea. Let's go for it. So that's exactly what happened. And now 9 years later, we've decided to restage it. And because now I'm running or helping to run the Backwell Playhouse, which is a theatre in North Somerset in Backwell, I decided to restage it again in a slightly different way. And hence, that's why we're now doing it again. He influenced all the great poets, such as Keats, Wordsworth. Hence, that's why Wordsworth was the one that called him the Marvellous Boy. That's where it all comes from.
So do you think your show particularly is going to do a lot for people's general knowledge about the poet? And is that something that you're trying to achieve?
Yeah, we are trying to do that.
I asked Dr. Daniel Cook from Bristol University what he felt should be done to increase consciousness of this poet. Do you think that your show eventually might have a place maybe in schools or choirs?
Yeah, we would love to think that it would do. Promoting it it's not an easy task, but we're doing our very best to do so. I think for a 17-year-old to play this lead of this lad, who was actually 17 years old when he died, it's brilliant, and I think they would learn a lot from it as well.
Mm. Well, maybe there's an opportunity here tonight because we've had the young people in with the competition.
We have indeed. Yeah.
Writing, and maybe your association with the Chatterton Society will mean we hear lots more of the show.
Let's hope we do. Yeah.
Terry, thank you very much.
Absolute pleasure.
Thank you.
Well, thank you to the composer Terry Milton and Dr. Daniel Cook of Bristol University for their time there, being interviewed by Lucy Hillier. They were chatting about Chatterton, who, of course, died. They thought it was a suicide for many years, for over a century. These days, they suspect that it was an accidental overdose of arsenic and laudanum that he was taking to cure a bad case of venereal disease. So next time, if you happen to see a smackhead knocking off a prostitute in St. Paul's, be quick not to judge. He may be a genius poet.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk.
Well, a little bit globe-trotting. We've been to Paris, now we're back to Oxfordshire, Tame in Oxfordshire to be precise, in the 1920s, where Mr. John Fothergill took up being an innkeeper and a landlord. He'd never done it before, so he wrote a diary about his experiences. So here's another episode of Malcolm Greaves reading an episode of The Innkeeper's Diary.
An Innkeeper's Diary by John Fothergill. Founders. There are limits to forcing a trade. I don't think this place could ever succeed financially. But we've made a profit this year, and it all went as usual on keeping the fabric together. Our overdraft is funnier than ever before at this period of the year, and the turnover is less. What could be expected with a 100 miles drive for dinner and back? Very little more than we get now, and there is Reigate and Dorking with not a decent meal to be had anywhere, with thousands almost complaining. Lucas Scudamore told me tonight that he simply couldn't attempt a meal at Reigate the other day, so he went to London instead. I took this place on for what its local trade was worth, and I never dreamt of Oxford, which has made a losing job at least a living, and a great privilege. Seymour Leslie, founder, in that he brought the very first person from Oxford. Arundel DeRay, who were quickly followed by the right kind of undergraduate, and better Don. Piers Sinnott, Benoît Tiskevich, Basil Murray, Lord Elmley, Patrick Balfour, Lord Donegal, Mary Somerville, John Pilley, Michael Russell, Peter Knox, Richard Norbury, Dickon Hughes, Thomas Alston. I put up a tablet in my heart to these early founders, and to those from the outer world: Kathleen Mann, Lady Queensberry, Francis Maynell, Musgrave and Aminta Dine, Mr. H. H. Asquith, Lady Pollock, Evan Morgan, Mrs. Sidney Ball, the Burgle brothers, Michael and Chatty Salaman Knox, E.V.R.A. and A.D., Ernest Guy, Jim Baird, Evie Lucas, Ming A.P. Herbert, Daisy Blunt, Albert and Mrs. Vanderveld, and many that don't come to my forgetful mind for the moment. And, oh my God, what a stream of life's consolations since. Delahaye, with his pretty, always prettier wife, said that some people told him of this place where a fellow called John Fothergill is rolling in money, whilst others ask why he chooses to lose money on keeping an inn like that. The former come on Sundays, I suppose, the latter on Mondays. I neither lose nor roll in it, but I often think that unless the decent and discriminating, for whom I keep this place, don't come more of them, I'll turn the place into a vast charabancari, despite them. In a German archaeological book with reference to the Boston Venus throne pendant, I see written, "As Fothergill has clearly laid down." Consolation to an obscure publican in Oxfordshire. Here we are doing nothing. Almost as bad as 2 years ago, when at the end of a day of doing absolutely nothing, we sold a piece of cake for fourpence, to go with a man's sherry, and I got to hear of it just in time to run out to him and ask him to take it back, with the pretext that the sherry had been overcharged for. Just in order to reach real rock bottom. But I am undisturbed, owing to Kate's optimism. She has taken on so much of my work, remembers everything I forget, whilst I sweat away at a gravy and grease extracting invention, a new theory and practice of learning French idioms, and other odd jobs, almost in peace and comfort. Arnold Gom, A.D. Knox and R.G. Collingwood all think the idiom theory very good. I once told John Marshall that some theory of mine seemed to hold water, and he replied that it seemed to hold little else. Professor Compagnac has also approved the theory, and is going to see what can be done with it. And besides being so comic a book that an ordinary publisher would blush to print it, it would be up against the vested interests, pride and prejudices of teachers. Tonight, Camem finished. I had had already sentimental goodbyes with one or two undergraduates who had finished their time, and at 11 o'clock I asked two more lads whom I really didn't know, just by way of something to say, being beastly tired, not to forget me. "I don't think I shall return," said one of them. "But why?" I asked, though not very interested to know the reason. "Because your men's lavatory isn't what it ought to be." Instead of telling him that I hoped he would return, even if it involved his bringing his own lavatory with him, I told him how, when I came here, I hadn't more money to make a better one, and now that after 9 years I had still less. Curious how large the lavatory looms in this diary. Eric Gill came. I was so glad to meet him so as now to dispel my ungenerous feelings towards him derived from what has always seemed to me, in his art, a pseudo-religious attitude towards copulation, and a pseudo-copulatory attitude towards religion, and to find that, instead of someone like great Agrippa, he's after all a charming, very human being, rather like Clutton Brock, with his witty contempt for generally accepted people and things. 1930. To the secretary of a very reputable distiller's, who wrote rather harshly, and as I thought tyrannously, about my delayed payment, I wrote that I, as their distributor, and not the consumer of their goods, was their agent, or servant, or indeed part of their own business, and that in these exceptionally bad times I had to spend their money as well as my own, with which to keep up my, and to a certain extent, their establishment, and pay the taxes, etc., till what time trade got better, when I could sell more of their stuff. The argument may be fallacious, but to my surprise the secretary replied most charmingly that at the moment they were so under the influence of my letter that they couldn't press me further, and asked me to pay them when I could. I'm ashamed to say that I then tried this argument on my German hock merchant, who declined to have it at any price, saying that if all his clients so argued, he would not be able to carry on himself. Fortunately, he's an amiable person. To Charles Prentice of Chatto and Windus, I sent these diary books for him to see what, if anything, could be done with such industry. He writes, suggesting that I publish excerpts just as they are. I hate the thought of it now. I'm better than this diary, the product of the fag ends of my daily supply of energy. I act and don't write. I can't see any interest to others in it. Anyhow, if you don't write about yourself nowadays, someone else will. I ask Prentice down to talk about it. He, or rather his affectionate silence, like David Garnett's Kate and Mary Somerville, finally persuaded me. I can't help it. So here goes. Let people reading it think perhaps less of me than I really am. And yet, if those who have been here, the lovely and the unlovely too, will think of me as an innkeeper at best, and as the best innkeeper, I am content.
Well, out some more tales from the Spread Eagle Inn in Tame in Oxfordshire, courtesy of John Fothergill, and more of Malcolm Grieve next week. Well, it's time to welcome to the studio once again Mr. Jeff Sparks. I'm pleased to see you're wearing a Skindred t-shirt.
Yeah.
Excellent band, and he's going to tell us what's on this week.
Thank you, John. Good evening. This is your What's On Guide from Dialect Radio. Starting with Thursday, 10th of December, and the 90s British rock group Skin have reformed and will be performing with support from Toby Jepson at the Thekla in Bristol. Doors open at 7 p.m. and tickets are £15 in advance. Moving on to Friday, 11th of December, Seth Lakeman will be performing at the O2 Academy in Bristol. Doors open at 6 p.m. and tickets are £16 in advance. On to Song of the Week, and I feature Skin. This group formed in 1992 and in their time have released several singles, two live albums and three studio albums before splitting up in 1998. They reformed earlier this year and performed at Download Festival, and they are on the UK tour later this month. I will announce the dates after the song, which is from the album Hasta la Vista Baby, which was released in 1998 and is titled Money. We'll be right back. That was Skin with Money from the album Hasta La Vista Baby. Now, as I said before the song, they're about to embark on a UK tour, so here are the dates. They start on December the 7th at the O2 Academy in Islington, London, then December the 10th at the Thekla in Bristol, December the 11th at Season at Manchester Club Academy in Manchester, and the final date is on December the 12th at Nottingham Rock City. For more information on Skin, you can check out www.skinfreak.co.uk. Into Saturday 12th of December, Dillinger 4 will be performing with support from the Cut-Ups and also the Archeries at the Fleece in Bristol. Doors open at 8 p.m. and tickets are £9 in advance. Also on 12th of December, Ye Gods will be performing at the Plough, which is in the High Street in Portishead. The gig starts at 9 p.m. and entry is free. On Sunday 13th of December, John Bramwell of I Am Clute fame will be performing with support at the Louisiana in Bristol. Doors open at 8 p.m. and tickets are £10 in advance. Finally, on Monday 14th of December, Hawkwind will be performing a special 40th anniversary show with support from the Crazy World of Arthur Brown at the O2 Academy in Bristol. Doors open at 7 p.m. and tickets are £20 in advance. That is all from me. Thanks for listening and have a great week. Take care and goodbye.
Thank you, Jeff. And now time for what we like to think of as an exclamation mark at the end of the show to set us all off nicely. He's the Bard of Windmill Hill. It's Trevor. Hello.
Hello. Hello, John.
What have you got to offer us this week?
I've got a little psychogeographical snapshot. It's called Strange Times.
Take it away.
On our islands of uncertainty, washed by the waves of doubt, we wrestle with anxieties of what it's all about. The rocks of long past ages are crumbling as we speak. The threats of earthly changes are making us feel weak. Will the mountains of confidence submerge themselves quite soon? Will belief in our omnipotence melt at nature's next high noon? There's a sense of some conclusion wafting on the winds of change, as we flounder in confusion, knowing life will get more strange.
Thank you kindly. I understand you've got another one for us. News about the banks never seems to go away. So you've got something about that?
Yes. There's another commentary on this sad ongoing saga.
Okay.
It's called Easy Winnings. Debt hangs like the sword of Damocles over quantitative easing, although almost everyone agrees it's a deed that must be done. While the banks have brought us to our knees, the economies are wheezing. So in an effort to appease, more money must be spun to help maintain the bankers' fees so that they can go on squeezing to profit from the great disease and do what must be done. The bankers claim their expertise is worth the cash they're seizing. They will ignore the casualties who've lost while they have won.
Excellent.
Thank you. Can I just give a plug to the Lansdowne Cabaret next weekend?
Of course you may.
Thank you very much.
When is it?
The 10th and the 11th, Thursday and Friday night at the Lansdowne.
Mm-hmm.
Tickets £7, entertainment on all fronts, with the magnificently modest Matt Pang, the Magical Simon,
okay,
myself, and a host of circus stars, too numerous to mention.
Where is it?
At the Lansdowne Pub, £7.
Where is the Lansdowne Pub?
The Lansdowne Pub, Clifton Road. Clifton.
Well, how could you fail to be entertained by people called Steve Pang and Magical Simon?
Matt Pang. There's circus people there as well.
Matt Pang.
Yeah.
Excellent. Well, that's all for this week's show from myself, John Peters Coleman, and Katie Austin. Dialect is a weekly community internet radio show produced by volunteers and broadcast on BCFM 93.2, which is between Radio 3 and Radio 4 on your dial, across Bristol at 9 o'clock every Saturday evening. If you're on the internet, you can find us at dialectradio.co.uk, that's all one word, and you can also find us at bristol.indymedia.org.uk, And you can listen live on the internet from anywhere at bcfm.org.uk. Lots of orgs. Dialect is a Bristol Radio co-op production, and that means anyone can contribute because it's a cooperative. So if you'd like to, either in reporting or engineering, or you just want to come along and sort of see how you might want to get involved, do please get in touch via Volunteering Bristol on 0117 989 7733 or on the web at bristolvolunteers.org.uk. Thank you very much to our studio guests. We've had Jane Sullivan in chatting to Katie Austin. We've also had the Bard of Wenmill Hill. Reports this week by Anthea Page and Tony Gosling and Lucy Hillier. Studio production this week was by Mark Condon, and producer was Tony Gosling. Well, that was Dialect Radio, and I'm going to wish you a very good week from all the team in Queen Square Studio in Bristol City Centre. Thank you for your company, and until the same time next week, goodbye. You can subscribe to our RSS feed and download our podcasts from dialectradio.co.uk.